Welcome to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard weekly at this time on 1450 AM and 107.1 FM. Today's guests are Dr. Greg Engel and Dr. Mona Janfaza, breast surgeons at UPMC Hammett. Doctors, thanks so much for joining us. Dr. Engel, can you share a little bit about your background and what led you to your current position at UPMC Hammett?
I was raised in Erie, graduated from Strong Vincent, did all my education for the most part in Western Pennsylvania, spent my college years in Allegheny and my medical school down at the University of Pittsburgh. Came back to start my general surgery training here at Hammett, finished my training in Harrisburg. When I left Hammett, the people I was working with basically had told me if I wanted a job to let them know when I finished my training and they would hire me. And here I am. I had left Erie when I graduated from high school thinking I would never come back. Having lived various other places in the country, I realized for all the reasons I probably didn't like growing up here a whole lot, I realized it was a great place to bring kids up. So came home.
I would imagine under the UPMC umbrella, you've seen a lot of changes.
Yeah, I started in practice in 1991 as a general surgeon, basically doing a lot of everything. Involved in the trauma program, involved in just about anything general surgeons do. Probably about 15 years ago, mostly because of some influence that I had from my senior partner, who was my mentor, started moving in towards breast care and taking care of breast cancer and focusing on women's care. And the partners that I was working with at that point in time supported me in my career choice and my life decisions and allowed me to kind of move away from the general surgery world and into focusing on breast cancer. And so, again, for about the past 15 years, that's really what I've done. We developed the breast program here at Hammett probably about 12 years ago. I'm trying to think. Mitty Hins was one of the administrators that Hammett had brought in to spearhead the whole development of women's health care in the institution. And then it was, 2011 when the merger occurred between UPMC and Hammett, which professionally was a very good thing for me. It opened the doors to McGee. It opened the doors to collaboration and help and just information flow between what we were doing up here. We had a significant amount of administrative support, both from the institution as well as from Pittsburgh, to build the program.
Dr. Janfaza, can you share a little bit about your background and what led you to your current position at UPMC Hammett?
Sure. I began my surgical training in California, so from Southern California originally, and then that led me to want to specialize in breast oncology, breast health, and so I ended up doing a fellowship in breast surgery in Michigan. So we completed that in 2016. I stayed in Michigan and practiced for about 3 years. And then it was pretty much just time for a change. And the position here at Erie was very attractive with Dr. Engel being an accredited breast program. In addition to that, personally, me and my husband like to do a lot of recreational activities. And so we're big water enthusiasts. So being here near the lake was perfect for us. So that's what led me to Erie.
What is the significance of October and Breast Cancer Awareness Month? And do you believe there is a greater understanding of this disease because of the national focus of this month?
I do. I do believe there's a greater understanding of the disease because of October being Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I think early detection is key. I think patients having being accessible to mammograms, having mammograms accessible to them is also key. And so events like the Mammo Marathon that's happening and different things going on in October to highlight Breast Cancer Awareness Month for the women in the community is very important. It brings everything to the forefront of their mind. And if a woman hasn't had her mammogram yet, It definitely reminds her that she needs to do that. Given that breast cancer is the most common cancer in women, and 1 in 8 women in their life will be touched by it, it's a very large population that we take care of.
Dr. Engel, same question. What is the significance of October and Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and do you believe there is a greater understanding of this disease because of the national focus of this month?
I think, you know, when I reflect on what this is about and what it means, you know, I kind of look at it from three levels. I think it's a celebration of the women who are diagnosed and are being treated and have survived and what they've gone through in their path with the disease. And I think it's just a recognition for what they've had to go through and helping understand where they may have gone or where they're coming from. On the second tier, I think it's a celebration or a remembrance of those who've had the disease and have not survived, and just kind of being able to reflect on their lives and what they've meant to us, because there probably isn't a whole lot of people out there that don't have some connection to a coworker, a parent, a sister, a cousin, who the family has been affected by the disease at some level, and the outcomes aren't always perfect. But I think the third level of what the month for October is really supposed to signify is the remembrance of all those women who, back in the 60s and 70s and earlier, agreed to be involved in clinical trials that really allowed us to get to where we are now. The whole concept of breast conservation and doing a lumpectomy is based on women who are brave enough to look at the consent and actually sign that piece of paper saying, we're going to do this or we're going to do that, and it's going to be randomized, and we don't know whether you're going to die sooner because you did this instead of that. So that I think the true meaning for the month of October is to thank those women who had the bravery and the courage to consent to be involved in trials that continue to allow us to evolve and develop the care that we're able to give now, based on asking a question, which is better? And we don't know the answer until we see the outcomes from the trials.
You aren't just seeing women, right? You're seeing men as well?
Correct. I mean, breast cancer in men is not common. I probably see 2 or 3 a year. Mm-hmm. It's just not common. I probably see 6 to 10 new diagnoses in women every month. And when we do see it in men, it is not always associated with a genetic abnormality, but it frequently will be. We can see it run in families. I can think off the top of my head where I have at least 2 families where I've taken care of the father and taken care of the son. So it's one of those things where it's not common, but you still just need to kind of be vigilant. And if you notice that something just doesn't feel right or doesn't look right, you have somebody look at you.
Dr. Jane Fazzo, what does self-awareness mean today to you, and what do you recommend to your patients?
So self-awareness to me, and goes right along with my recommendations for monthly self-breast exams for the women that we see. Typically, when I see a woman in my office for the first time as a new patient, for whatever condition she might have, maybe it's breast pain or a breast mass, anything at all, we go through the technique of how to do a self-breast exam. We talk about the best time of the month to do that, which is the week after their menstrual period if they're still having cycles, and the technique in doing a self-breast exam. Many of our patients come in to see us after having diagnosed with breast cancer on a lump that they found themselves that was not found by a clinical provider, maybe because they hadn't had a physical that year yet, or maybe they haven't been to the doctor in a number of years. And so being able to know the technique on how to do a self-exam, I think, is important for every woman.
Dr. Engel, can you expand on the warning factors?
You know, looking at that whole process historically, the concept of self-exam came out in an era when mammography was just starting, and there were all these guidelines that were written, and, you know, it was pretty much dictated and mandated that you had to do your exam in this way, and you had to do this, and you had to do that, and you had to lay in bed, put a towel roll on your shoulder, you know, and feel. You had to do it in the shower when things were wet so that you could feel potentially something smaller that you wouldn't have noticed before. and you had to. And if you did it wrong, it almost like they made you feel guilty because you didn't do something right. There was not an insignificant population of women who were terrified of doing a self-examination because, what am I feeling? What does this mean? Is this good? Is this bad? I don't know what to do. I'm just not going to do it because I don't know what it means or what to do with it. And then the data started coming out basically showing that doing the self-exam under that regimen probably really didn't add a whole lot of benefit. It wasn't affecting outcomes. It wasn't affecting detection. And we moved more into a philosophy of lumpy and bumpy breasts are normal. You know, that's just the nature of the gland. It's the nature of the tissue. Everybody who examines themselves is going to feel something. So the issue is not to panic when you feel something, but to recognize what your normal is. Because everybody's lumpy and bumpy, but everybody's normal is going to be different. The only way you know what your normal is to examine yourself intermittently. Does it have to be every month? No, nobody's going to yell at you if you miss a month. You know, does it have to be done in a certain way? No, the key thing is to just understand what my normal is. And the question you're asking yourself then isn't so much that, oh my gosh, is this good or bad? It's, was it there before, or does it seem like it's changed at all? The next step, if either of those answers is yes, is you don't worry about it. You don't stew about it at home. You get on the phone and call a clinician and say, hey, something's different. Would you look at me? What they found is when they compared those women who were yelled at if they did something wrong versus those who just got help when they thought something was going on, there was really no difference in outcomes. There was no difference in detection. But things were being picked up earlier because they got evaluated. You know, because usually that evaluation would lead to some sort of imaging, and it's the imaging that really allows us to pick things up at an earlier stage.
Dr. Gianfaza, can you expand on how important early detection is, and what are some myths?
Definitely. Early detection is essential for a number of reasons. Patients that have their mammograms once a year, that their cancers are found at a much earlier stage, have a much better outcome. They have a much better survival rate. You know, early stage breast cancer has an excellent survival rate. You know, 99 stage one, there's some studies that report 100% survival rate for stage one. Because the disease is caught early, those women also have the option of doing a much minimally invasive treatment, be it a lumpectomy like Dr. Lingle was talking about versus a mastectomy. And so they typically may or may not need chemotherapy the earlier that these cancers are found. The tumor biology also plays into what treatment regimens a patient needs. However, just generally across the board, the earlier the cancer is found, the less invasive the treatment plan needs to be. So, and that goes along with lower complication rates and better outcomes. So that's, I think, what the significance of finding these cancers at a much smaller, much earlier stage brings us. Myths as far as breast cancer, there's quite a few that I get frequently. The myth of a biopsy being done possibly spreading the disease or spreading the tumor cells is not accurate. I frequently am asked about whether deodorant causes breast cancer, which there hasn't been any data to prove that either. Those are probably the two most common myths that I get.
When it comes to treatment and someone is really susceptible due to hereditary, does that lend itself to more aggressive treatment early on?
Generally, because the genetically driven cancers tend to be those that are biologically more aggressive, there's a disease entity that we talk about called triple negative disease. Basically, when we look at breast tumors, we're looking at certain markers. HER2 is a protein that directs how cells grow. Estrogen and progesterone receptors are proteins that, if the estrogen in your bloodstream binds to them, it stimulates growth, so it can actually stimulate the growth of breast cancer. So when we see that those receptors are positive or those markers are positive, that adds into the regimen the ability to use certain treatments. when those markers are negative, it really takes out a play of using some treatments that work really well, and some of them are pretty benign. We see those triple negative diseases a lot more associated with the, again, the abnormal gene-driven cancer. Also understanding that when we look at those, that population of women who have an abnormal gene which is driving their cancer risk, it's only about 10% of the population that will have those genetic abnormalities. So when we start looking as to whether that's an issue or a question that needs to be addressed, there are guidelines and criteria that we actually look at to say, okay, well, looking at your family history, looking at, you know, your disease process, looking at your age of diagnosis, you probably don't have a whole lot of criteria that fits in to say, hey, this is something we need to worry about. Like I say, so we do have these guidelines that we look at, that we can look at somebody and say, well, you know, you've got this cluster of cancers that are going up both sides of your families, you know, whether it's involving breast, ovarian, prostate, you know, pancreatic cancer. We look at patterns. The genetic counselors are the smartest people I've ever worked with in my life. I tell everybody, if you've got kids and they're in college and you want them to get a job, tell them to get a master's degree in genetics, because they'll get a job. There are just not enough of the counselors out there in the world. They may not get paid a whole lot, but they will get a job. But they also have to be some of the most intelligent people that I've ever worked with when they understand that, so that they're able to kind of look at the pedigree, look at the families. And when we started looking at genetic issues, it was relatively easy because we just looked at the BRCA1 and 2 genes. Now when they look at patients, they're looking at the whole history and putting it together and saying, do we need to look at 8 genes? Do we look at 19 genes? Do we look at 35 genes? You know, what kind of picture do we need to put together to say? And really all that does for the most part is define risk. When we have patients that are affected with cancer and we put them through this process of being counseled and tested, it's not so much necessarily to guide what we're going to do for them, although it does open up some options on how we approach them, but it also is very meaningful for the family, because if they are shown to harbor a mutation, which is an issue, then they got it from somewhere. They either got it from mom or dad. So then it applies to their siblings. It applies to their nieces and nephews. It applies to their kids. It applies to their grandchildren, just for the way genetics works. So, you know, the biggest issue is that not very many people will have it to begin with. So there's the criteria that we use to try to judge who's important, because we don't want to really put everyone through genetic counseling. I mean, it's just, and particularly when you have a new diagnosis and you're being overwhelmed by all the information that you're trying to gather about, okay, oh my God, I have cancer. What does this mean? What does this mean? All of a sudden, then you add on this layer of complex information about genetics. It just gets to be a real sensory overload.
What changes have you seen in breast health and breast surgery over the years?
I've seen the surgeries getting less and less invasive is probably the biggest change. You know, going back traditionally, what was done turn of the century treatment for breast cancer was a complete mastectomy, all the lymph nodes being removed, sometimes even chest walls being removed. It led to lots of deformity, lots of complications, and the data has shown that you don't have any increased survival benefit for being that aggressive. And so as the years have gone by, it's gotten less and less, to the point that even now, even in, you know, the last 5 years that I've been practicing, we're noticing a trend of doing less, say, lymph node sampling. When a woman has breast cancer and the lymph nodes have to be tested, have to be sampled, or have to be removed, it's much more of a targeted surgery to that area than this kind of complete clearing out of those lymph node basins. And so they're finding that in addition to adjunctive treatments such as radiation can be just as beneficial and frequently have less complication rates for these women, such as lymphedema, what they would have to live with, which is a chronic problem. So I think that's been the biggest thing that I've seen. The genetic component has also been a very big change. Years ago, the number of women that would have been referred to a genetic counselor would have been very, very select. Right around, I think it was about 2013, is when they really opened the door, the NCCN guidelines really opened the door and kind of to a much larger percentage of women that could make it to a genetic counselor to at least be evaluated to see if they needed to be tested. And now we're seeing some recommendations from different organizations that are recommending every patient that's diagnosed with breast cancer to see a genetic counselor, which, in my opinion, is quite over. The pendulum is swinging to the other side now, where to test every woman would be a very large number of women to be tested to capture 10% of women that might have a genetic component to their breast cancer. I don't feel that that's in the women's best interest or very cost effective. But being, you know, careful in scrutinizing which patient population would benefit from genetic counseling also, I think, has been a change recently.
Just to expound on that a little bit, when that call for that testing came out, the response from the genetic sides, from the geneticists and the genetic counselors, was the issue is that when you do testing, yes, 10% of the time you're going to find genes that are definitely considered abnormal. But understanding the complexity of genetics and how the genome works, you see a significant amount of what they call variants of unknown significance, VUSs, which means that, yes, there's a variance in the makeup of your DNA, but there's no data to suggest whether that variance actually is an issue that causes or drives changes, or whether it's just a normal variant, in the same way that someone's going to have red hair and someone's going to have blonde hair. You know, I mean, it's normal hair, but it's different color. So that the floodgate of the VUSs that would come out that would then allow everybody to totally panic because, oh my gosh, what does this mean? When in fact it's meaningless, it would just overwhelm the system. So I think the best thing to do at this point is to stick with the guidelines we have, understanding that nothing is perfect and that those guidelines probably will let some people slip through the cracks who don't fit the criteria perfectly but may have a mutation, as opposed to just overwhelming the system so nobody can get anything done.
Dr. Engel, what changes in technology have happened in recent years, and what technology exists only at UPMC Hammett for those afflicted with this terrible disease?
The one thing that we are able to offer that isn't necessarily out there in the market is partial breast radiation. So when we talk about doing breast conservation, really that means that we do a lumpectomy. You want to get rid of the tumor out of the breast, but you don't necessarily have to take the whole breast to treat the disease. But then you have to do something to treat the rest of the breast most of the time, which entails either radiation therapy in the traditional sense was whole breast radiation, where you would get an external beam of high energy x-rays basically through the breast tissue, which was a few minute treatment every day for 4.5 to 5 weeks. It used to be 6 weeks. They were actually able to show that they could cut that down to 4.5 to 5 weeks and get the same outcomes. As opposed to partial breast radiation, which is where we're able to target the breast tissue, which is at highest risk for recurrence, which is the tissue that was directly adjacent to where the tumor was. And we're able to do that with certain systems where you can get two treatments a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, for 5 days and be done with it. Understanding that it's about a two-week course of logistics to get there. For the most part, I think what I've seen change over time is back in the ice ages when I was training, breast cancer was treated as breast cancer. It was a single disease entity. It was a cancer that if you were diagnosed, you got a modified radical mastectomy. You lost your breast and we did an axillary dissection. And again, to touch on what Dr. Genfaza just mentioned, you know, the radical surgery, which had been done since the turn of the century in the 1900s, was thought to be beneficial because you were taking away the pathways for the cancer to spread. But when you actually looked at it, doing more radical surgery did not affect outcomes. You would still develop metastatic disease or distant disease in the future. So that raised the question of where did it come from? Which then brought in the whole thought process, well, is breast cancer systemic from the get-go, and do we actually add any benefit by removing the breast or amputating the organ, which led to the studies in the 60s and 70s which asked the question and actually answered it, saying, no, we don't need to take the breast to treat the disease. But I think also then over that time period, we realized that breast cancer wasn't breast cancer, wasn't breast cancer, wasn't breast cancer. There were different biologies, there were different families, there were different ways to treat it. And I think with the ongoing gain of knowledge on, and it's not just breast cancer, it's a lot of cancers across the board, but we're really starting to understand the molecular mechanism of what is going on with individual tumors, what pathway is broken down, you know, what's not functioning, you know, at what level in the cell, so that these targeted therapies are, and it's gotten to the point where I can't even remember all the drugs out there. As I go to the conference, I sit there with my phone open, looking at all of the names that come out there and have to remember, okay, this is something that, you know, deals with the kinase pathways versus the mTOR pathways versus, you know, the HER2 pathways versus the ER pathway. So that I truly think that in the future, surgery may not be something that's there for treat breast cancer. We may figure out exactly what abnormality is at the cell and be able to develop these drugs or even viral vectors, you know, that you can give that will put the gene back the way it's supposed to be and take care of things. I think, you know, Gene Roddenberry wasn't a dumb guy. I think Star Trek and tricorders are probably going to be sometime in the future, but not in my lifetime.
Dr. Jamfaza, can you elaborate on the importance of knowing family history and getting a possible risk assessment?
I can. Patients that would be considered in the high-risk population would, we have found, to benefit from a more stringent screening protocol. So the average risk patient, no family history, specific factors in their gynecologic history, say, you know, having a pregnancy and having a child before the age of 30 is protective for breast cancer, not having a history of hormone replacement therapy. There's different aspects in a gynecological history and then in a family history that would deem somebody an average risk patient, in which case a yearly mammogram would be sufficient, in addition to a yearly breast exam by a provider. And then again, you know, like we spoke about earlier, a monthly self-exam would be sufficient for a screening protocol. Patients that fall into the high-risk program have a positive family history for breast cancer, maybe one or more first-degree relatives that have had breast cancer. Maybe they've had history of radiation to their chest wall, for example. There's different factors that would place somebody in a high-risk category, and having a patient being seen at a high-risk breast program, such as at UPMC Hammett, we can identify those patients and make sure that they get the more customized screening protocols. And so that might include an MRI of the breast, that might include the yearly mammogram that an average risk patient gets, but we might add, say, a whole breast ultrasound to further evaluate them, especially in women that have dense breast tissue. We found that whole breast ultrasounds, in addition to the mammogram for that patient population with dense breast tissue, is beneficial for, again, early detection.
Doctors, thank you so much for your time and being with us today. Are there any final thoughts on Breast Cancer Awareness Month and the treatment provided by UPMC Hammett?
Understand that you've got a good group of people here in Erie that can take care of you, and we have a program that's more than willing to do so.
You know, any final words to the patient that just got, you know, maybe diagnosed, or perhaps she feels something now and she's scared to reach out? I would encourage them to call their doctor and go in to get an exam. Knowledge is power, and we have a lot of tools to help women. It's not, it is a very scary diagnosis to have. It's a very emotional diagnosis to have. We have a wonderful team here to see you through your journey and get you on the other side. So come in and see us.
Thanks for listening to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard Fridays at 12:30 p.m. Join us again next week as the Erie Regional Chamber and Growth Partnership is in the Business Spotlight.